pocket calculator. I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, which, as I'm sure you're aware, is one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and we do have a website for the program, which you can access at radioinvivo.net. You can get to all of our past programs on the website, and after more than a year and a half now of doing the program, it's quite an extensive archive on the wide variety of topics we've featured here on the show, so we hope you'll check it out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and you will get right to the podcast site. And, of course, we always have podcasts available on the station's website as well, which is at communityradio.coop. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences, research, and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and it is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. Well, this week on Radio In Vivo, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome Dr. Joanne Kurtzberg of Duke University to the microphone. She is a pioneer in the use of umbilical cord blood as a source of stem cells for transplantation and an expert in pediatric leukemias and other diseases. To run through Joanne's entire impressive biography would take about half of the show, so let me just give you her academic and clinical titles at Duke. She is professor of pediatrics and professor of pathology. She is also chief of the Division of Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplantation and co-director of the Stem Cell Laboratory at Duke. And she is also director of the Carolina's Cord Blood Bank, which was established at Duke with research funding from the National Institutes of Health. Joanne, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Hi, Ernie. Thank you very much.
Obviously, I want to spend much of our time together talking about cord blood. But first, I know that you've specialized to a great degree in your career in transplantation in the pediatric population. Why have you focused your practice and research on children to such a degree?
Well, I've always enjoyed working with children. So throughout my college career and medical school, I just always knew that I would focus on a specialty involving children. But I really see children as our future. I think in a lot of ways our society doesn't invest enough in our children. And in the field of medicine, there's a tremendous amount we can learn from childhood diseases and treatment thereof that really will impact our healthcare system for adults as well.
I see. That's certainly very, very laudable, and you've certainly been such a pioneer in the whole field. Could you give us just a broad overview of the use of stem cells derived from umbilical cord blood? What is involved with the procedure, and what conditions are they used in?
Well, cord blood is the baby's blood that's left over in the placenta, or the afterbirth, after a baby's born. And before 15 or so years ago, it was always discarded because there was no need for it.
Mm-hmm. It was considered medical waste.
It was definitely considered medical waste, except for a few cultures that had cultural beliefs around using the placenta to confer good luck on the baby's life.
I see.
But in most situations, it was discarded as medical waste. And back in the mid-80s, it was discovered that that cord blood contained blood stem cells that were similar to those cells that one sees in bone marrow. And it was hypothesized that maybe they could substitute for bone marrow in a bone marrow transplant. And I'll tell you more about that a little bit later.
Sure.
But just technically, you can take the afterbirth and you can collect the blood that's left over from the baby and no longer needed after the baby's born within about 10 or 15 minutes of the birth. And then you can test it and process it and freeze it and keep it for at least a decade and probably longer to use for a transplant later on.
I see. So what is the therapeutic modality that is at work here? Is it different in the blood cancers and in the genetic conditions that you treat?
Yeah, so both cord blood and bone marrow transplantation can be used to treat patients with cancer, and that was sort of the traditional use. And in that setting, patients who don't get better with standard chemotherapy need higher doses of radiation or chemotherapy, and when you administer those higher doses, the person's bone marrow, which is their blood factory and one of the few places in the body where cells divide, becomes an innocent bystander to the side effects of the drugs. And the bone marrow can be killed, and then you can't make blood, and that's not compatible with life. So a transplant is used in that setting to rescue the bone marrow after the patient gets high doses of treatment, usually chemotherapy and radiation, to try to kill their cancer. Mm-hmm. And in doing that kind of therapy, it was also learned that when you give someone else's cells back as the rescue, they can sometimes also fight the cancer. And so there's a graft versus leukemia effect that's been described as well. So there's two kind of uses for that kind of transplant. And it's different in genetic diseases because in genetic diseases, you're not fighting off bad cells.
Right.
But if you just took the transplant cells and put them in someone else's body to correct the disease, unfortunately, the person receiving them would reject them because our immune system is programmed to kill anything in our body that's not our own.
Graft versus host.
Well, that's really rejection.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I see.
Graft versus host is different. Graft versus host is when the new cells attack the person who received them.
Oh, okay. So this is actually, talking host versus graft.
Yeah, so this is when...
I should have known better.
That's okay. But when a child, say, with a genetic disease that really is not cancer, okay, has to have a transplant to correct their disease, we have to figure out a way to get the new cells to live in their body. And if you just give them, their body rejects them. So you still have to give those patients chemotherapy to suppress their own immune system so the new cells will be accepted.
I see. And is that permanent suppression of their own immune system?
It permanently wipes out, if you will, their own immune system. And then the new cells build a new blood system and a new immune system that comes from the donor.
I see. So they don't have to remain on immunosuppression.
Right. So exactly. So if somebody, it's different, say, than somebody who gets a heart transplant or kidney transplant where their immune system stays their own, the one they started with, and they can always reject that organ. So they have to stay on drugs that suppress that ability for their life. But when a person gets a cord blood or a bone marrow transplant, the transplant cells build the new immune system, and they only need to be on drugs for about a year. Then they can come off.
I see. Joanne, if my research is correct, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you were actually the first person to perform an umbilical cord blood transplant. And you and your group have performed more of those procedures than anyone in the world at this point. How did you come up with this idea?
By accident, really.
Okay. Like and, so much
and,
science.
And it's not just my idea. There really were a whole group of people working
I'm
in
sure.
the field who contributed. But there's a, it's a long story. We at Duke performed the first unrelated cord blood transplant in the world in 1993, and in fact have done the most in the world up to now, with being over 700. But in the world now, there are close to 9,000 transplants that have been performed worldwide, mostly in the last 5 years, as this has caught on and been proven to be an effective therapy. But the real story with cord blood starts in the mid-'80s, when people were working in the lab, and this is going to sound funny, but we used to grind up placenta to feed bone marrow cells in the culture dish, because placenta makes a lot of nutrients that... since then, many of them have been discovered, but in those days, we didn't know what they were.
Sure.
And in doing that, we noticed that some of the cells that came from the baby that were also in there grew better than the bone marrow cells. And they formed the same kind of blood-forming colonies, but with a higher rate of efficiency. Mm-hmm. So that started an investigation to look and see if really those cells were in bone marrow. I mean, I'm sorry, in cord blood.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
In 1987, a little boy was born in North Carolina with a genetic disease called Fanconi anemia. There's a little boy in North Carolina who in 1987's mother had another baby who was a match to this little boy and
uh-huh.
who was healthy. And her cord blood was saved to transplant him. And they went in 1988, which is before the time we had a transplant program at Duke, to France, where a doctor named Elian Gluckman performed the transplant. And in those days, using cord blood was considered crazy, that it would never work. Really, we're using a few ounces compared to a few liters, if you compare volume by volume to cord blood and bone marrow. But this little boy's transplant worked very well. He is... completely normal 19 years later.
Wow.
The cells that are in his blood are surviving from his sister, and he's the human experiment and the living proof that this really worked. After his transplant was done, and that's again between related people, there were a few more done like that, which also worked. And then the unrelated story unfolded, because there's too many people who don't have donors who need unrelated donors, can't find a real match. And it turns out cord blood is more tolerant of a new person than bone marrow. And so you can take cord blood and use it when it only partway matches,
mm-hmm.
when you
mm-hmm.
can't do that with bone marrow. So all the people that need a transplant, and the estimates are there are probably 15,000 to 20,000 people a year who need a transplant and will never find a full match,
right.
Can have access to cord blood and use a partially matched cord blood transplant.
So what is being matched in these mm-hmm. situations?
So we match by a system that's called HLA, which stands for human leukocyte antigens. And these are proteins on the surface of the cell, kind of like a fingerprint, that code who we are. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of proteins identified. To some degree, they match or they're inherited along ethnic backgrounds. And everybody has between 6 and 10 that are important and mm-hmm. code who they are. And then the matching is done based on the proteins on the cell and even behind that, the genes that code for those proteins.
Sure. So the only perfect match really would be an identical twin.
Right. The only perfect match is an identical twin. But within a family, one in four siblings who have the same biologic parents have a chance of matching at least those 10 places.
I see. So is that one of the main advantages of cord blood versus bone marrow for transplantation, the fact that it doesn't need to be as good a match?
Yeah, that's probably its main advantage. And, you know, if you think about it, when a baby is developing inside the mom, the baby and the mom only halfway match each other.
Right.
Because part of the baby's genetic makeup comes from the dad. And nature's put something in place already that allows the two to tolerate each other. And that tolerance is carried over to the cord blood so that it's more tolerant of a new person.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joanne, how does this procedure differ from autologous stem cell transplantation? Or when you're using bone marrow stem cells from the patient's own body to reintroduce them into your body after intensive chemotherapy?
Okay. So autologous transplantation, in the way we use it now, is usually reserved for a patient with cancer who... can be put into remission with standard therapy, but where you know they're going to relapse and that they're not cured yet.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be able to give them high-dose therapy. And you can take their cells from their peripheral blood or their bone marrow, freeze them away in a freezer, then give them the high doses of chemotherapy, and then essentially infuse their own cells to rescue their bone marrow. And while technically that's simple and it works very well, mm-hmm. the problem with it is that most people who go through that procedure still relapse from their cancer. And in the setting of genetic diseases, we don't have a way to fix the genes in the vast majority of diseases, so giving back a person's own cells won't correct their disease.
I see. Well, tell us about the mechanics of acquiring the cord blood. I assume it all begins with the excision of the umbilical cord after a birth. Does that need to be done quickly, and what happens after that?
Okay, so cord blood can be collected pretty much from any delivery, whether it's a mom who has a C-section or a mom who has a vaginal delivery, whether it's a mom who's induced or who spontaneously goes into labor, and it really doesn't matter on the what phase of pregnancy the mom is in. So even if the baby's premature, it can be collected, but you'll get a smaller amount because the baby's smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And technically what happens is the baby is born, the cord is cut, and the care of the baby and the cord is identical to what you would do if you were not collecting cord blood. But after the baby's born, the cord's cut, the baby is hopefully crying and being welcomed into the world.
Right.
There's a few minutes before the placenta actually delivers, or the afterbirth delivers. And during that time, you can stick a needle, after cleaning off the umbilical cord that's still hanging down, into the vein from the umbilical cord and just drain the blood into a bag. Or conversely, you can wait till the afterbirth comes out, and you can take it into a laboratory, put it up on a stand, and collect the cord blood the same way. Put a needle in the vein and let it drip by gravity into a bag that has blood thinner in it so that the blood won't clot.
I see.
And typically you want to do that between about 2 and 15 minutes from the delivery, because after that the blood does clot.
Mm-hmm.
And typically you'll collect over about 5 to 9 minutes, anywhere from 3 to 6 ounces of cord blood.
I see. And so how many stem cells are you ultimately able to extract from those samples?
Well, you know, it's a great question, but we really don't know the answer because we really don't know how to look for stem cells. We have lots of what we call surrogate assays that we think mark populations that correlate with stem cells, but nobody's really found the stem cell in cord blood. And mm-hmm. my personal belief is that there are probably several kinds of stem cells in cord blood, not just one. But we use assays in the lab to enumerate young cells, and we can get on the order of 3 to 4 million of those cells in a billion cord blood cells. And that's about a log to two logs lower than what you would take from bone marrow.
I see. Well, that presents a few technical problems on the other end mm-hmm. during the transplantation phase, in that you are getting these much smaller amounts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, cell for cell, cord blood is enriched for these progenitor and stem cells, but still the amount of cells, the total numbers are literally a log less than what we would give in a traditional bone marrow transplant. And what we've learned about cord blood is that we're working right on the threshold of what an adequate cell dose is. And when we first started, we didn't really know that. And when children were transplanted, it seemed there were enough cells for the average size child, and it didn't come up. Mm-hmm. But as soon as cord blood transplantation started to be used in adults, it was realized that not every unit has enough cells to say one unit can be enough to transplant one adult. And there have been lots of people working on getting around that obstacle. And one way is the group in Minnesota has pioneered putting two cord bloods together, and that doubles the dose. It's very interesting because it does make more adults do well with a cord blood transplant, but only one unit takes, even though you give two. So we're not sure what that second unit is really doing.
Okay.
And
okay.
We don't have a way to predict. It's not the bigger one or the better matched one, or all these numbers of things we can measure don't predict which unit will take. So that's a very interesting biologic mystery that still has to be solved.
I'm sure you will figure that out.
We're trying.
Before long.
The other thing people are doing is what's called ex vivo expansion, trying to grow and expand stem cells in culture.
I was going to ask you about that. That would seem to be a logical route to take.
Yeah. And again, because this is the obstacle we have here is not having a stem cell assay, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So everything we use to say we're growing stem cells is a surrogate assay. So people have used four or five different techniques to, quote unquote, expand cells and culture for anywhere from a few days to a month. And you can grow these cells and you can make many more of them. But when you put them back into the person, they don't seem to be different than if you hadn't expanded them at all.
Is that right?
So I think we don't know the right endpoint yet.
Mm-hmm. And isn't there a barrier in that the cells actually also start to differentiate and start doing their yeah. thing they were intended to do?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, a stem cell should have the ability to reproduce itself without differentiating and also to produce daughter cells that do differentiate. But once you produce those daughter cells that differentiate, it's like a suicide mission mm-hmm. because those cells will have a lifespan and a job, and then they will die. And it's very easy to expand that kind of cell.
Right.
But no one has really figured out how to expand the true stem cell that just repopulates itself without differentiation.
So there's a lot of bench work yet mm-hmm. to be done.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that'll keep you busy for a while.
Yeah.
Joanne, how difficult and how extensive is the current informed consent process for donations? Has, mm-hmm. has HIPAA made this more challenging? And, you know, you've been doing this very successfully for more than a decade. Has it gotten any easier to gain consent at this point?
Well, let me just ask you, because you mean consent of the moms to donate?
Yes, for the donations.
Well, nothing's easier. I think our world continues to get more complex, but I would say the majority of people who bank cord blood believe very strongly that the mom needs to be consented before the collection, because even though it used to be medical waste, now we know it's not medical waste and it has a purpose. So mm-hmm. In our bank and in most banks, the moms are, there's a lot of efforts to educate them through community processes, through their clinic visits to their OBs, through hospital tours, through prenatal education, to know that there's the possibility to do this and that they have the option to do it. Mm-hmm. But when it comes right down to it, the cord blood can only be collected if the mom has signed a written informed consent, which is unfortunately 14 pages long and single-spaced. So
wow.
It's real detailed. And the essence of it is that they know that they're making a voluntary donation, that they understand that this will be used by the public and that they have equal access to it, but not special access to it.
Right.
That they understand that it's not guaranteed it would be banked, because only certain units make it to the bank. They have to meet certain criteria and pass certain tests.
Mm-hmm.
And that the mom herself gives her a sample of her blood to be tested for infectious diseases like AIDS and hepatitis, just like any other blood donor.
Sure.
And that if she gives consent, that if her test is positive, it has to be reported back to her doctor and the state lab, and she will be notified as well. And then finally, that the unit could be tested later for a genetic disease if a recipient is identified that has a genetic disease, to make sure that family doesn't carry the disease. But if something was discovered and it was important to the family, it would be reported back to them so that their own health could be protected. And
sure.
confidentiality is maintained through the whole system by barcoding. But there is one link in a special non-linked networked file that does connect the mom's demographics, which means her contact information mm-hmm. and her hospital number, with the barcode that's assigned to the cord blood.
I see.
Yeah.
It sounds like a pretty
so
refined
and
pretty arcane system at this point. You know, Joanne, are there people who are still resistant to this concept for whatever reason? I'm allowed to editorialize. You know, this just seems to me that it should be one of those, you know, we're going to do this unless you specifically order us not to
mm-hmm.
type of situations. That's my opinion. After all, this is a totally non-invasive use of what, as we've discussed, used to be considered medical waste. I guess I don't identify the potential value is so high, I don't identify with resistance.
Well, I would say in general, the vast majority of moms want to be donors, so there's not a lot of resistance on the part of the mom.
Okay, good. I'll calm down.
But on the other hand, there are the other options people have now besides donating to a public bank. And one of those is donating to a private bank where the cord blood is stored for use by that family in the future.
I was going to ask you about
yeah.
that. Is that a practice that is going on at present?
This is America, and yes.
People are making a business out of it,
which I personally don't believe it should be. But that's my personal belief. So, yes, there is a huge business component to this on the private side, not the public side.
Mm-hmm. And what would it cost? What do these companies get to?
Well, you know, I only know the ranges. Kind of I know that companies are charging somewhere between $1,000 and $2,000 for the initial collection and storage, and then some kind of storage fee per year.
Mm-hmm.
And I can also tell you that for the most part, the companies don't do as much testing or follow the same regulations that are required for the public banks. So they don't have the same expenses that the public banks have. In the public bank, it cost about $1,600 to collect, test, process, store, and bank a unit. And mm-hmm. it's a very elaborate process.
Sure.
And, of course, the donor wouldn't pay for that because they're making a public donation. And that's why we have federal support to support the public program. But on the private side, there are corners cut and smaller volumes that may or may not ever be useful are stored. And there are claims made that cord blood can cure diseases that we all hope someday it might be able to, but there's no evidence right now that it can. But bottom line, moms do have the option to do that kind of donation. And
Are they often approached in the hospital setting or prenatally?
Prenatally, there's huge marketing. I mean, if you go buy some maternity clothes and look at the stuff on the bottom of the bag, it's all kinds of flyers about private cord blood donation. And I think through other marketing attempts, they're called. They are on mailing lists. Mm-hmm. They're approached before they go into the hospital because it isn't very practical to organize it in the hospital if you haven't made arrangements beforehand.
Of course.
Now, there is one set of circumstances where it does make sense to do not a private donation, but what we call a directed donation. And that's in a family where there's already another child who has a disease that might someday need a transplant.
Sure.
That would be leukemia, sickle cell anemia, thalassemia, mm-hmm. immune deficiency, or the bubble boy syndrome, and certain other genetic diseases. And in those families, when another child is born, the cord blood should be saved. And because of recognition that it's important for those cord bloods to be very high quality, the government is now planning through legislation that was passed a couple of years ago to fund that part of the project through public banks.
Mm-hmm.
So families mm-hmm. would be identified. They would not be charged. The cord blood would be saved, and it would be handled properly because those have a very high chance of being used for transplant for a sibling in the family.
Sure, and of course that makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a mechanism coming into place
yes.
for
yes.
that type of donation.
Yes.
Well, that's wonderful. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Joanne Kurtzberg of Duke University. And as you've been hearing, we're talking about her work and mainly about umbilical cord blood stem cell transplants. Joanne, what types of screening procedures do you conduct on the units that you do get? You mentioned that the mothers are screened for infectious diseases. What is the screening procedure for the donated cord blood itself?
So there are multiple levels that they're screened at. First, the baby is examined, and we're ensured that the baby doesn't have any birth defects that could be associated with blood disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Second, a very careful history is taken from the mother about her history and her family's history and the dad's family's history to make sure there are no patterns of inherited diseases that, again, could be transmitted in the blood.
I see.
Third, the cord blood itself is tested in the laboratory multiple ways, including counting, enumeration of certain cells. Probably the most important thing we do is we grow it, and we make sure that what we call progenitor cells, or very immature blood cells, can grow from the cord blood because that predicts its health.
I see.
And we culture it to make sure it's not contaminated with any viruses or bacteria. Then it's frozen, and in the bag that it's frozen, there are three segments attached. And later on, we can take off one of those segments and make sure the cells are still alive and that they still grow properly before it's transplanted, so that we can ensure that nothing happened in the storage process that
sure.
affected the health of the cells.
So there's another screening just before it's used for transplantation.
That's right.
I see. Well, that brings us to the patient side of things,
mm-hmm.
and then we certainly want to spend some time on that. What are the typical long-term outcomes in the patients who receive these transplants? Is this the type of thing that extends life for a certain period of time, as the so-called 5-year survival standards in adult cancer patients? That seems to be the statistic that we so often hear about? Or does this often result in long-term remissions and relatively normal lifespans?
I think the latter is more true, but I have to answer the question in a complicated way.
Please do.
First of all, in treating patients with cancer, and that's really whether they're children or adults, they've already failed the standard therapy. So without a transplant, they are not going to survive their cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And when patients go through a transplant, which again gives them very high doses of medicine and radiation, and then a rescue with these new cells, the new cells also help fight the cancer. And depending on the type, the age of the patient, et cetera, the cure rates, which means the cancer is cured and the patient is well for an indefinite period of time.
Mm-hmm. I was hesitating to use that word cure.
Yeah.
I know that's a sensitive word.
But for cancer, you can use the word cure.
Okay.
And the rates will be as low as 20% in some very aggressive diseases or older adults to as high as 80 or 90% in some very young children with very responsive diseases. But overall, the average is around 58 to 60%. And in these kind of cancers, most relapses occur before a year. So what you see is that the people that are going to get into trouble and fail early,
mm-hmm.
and that once
mm-hmm.
you get past a year, you have a very high probability of being cured. And certainly beyond 5 years, there are no recurrences of the cancer that the patient was transplanted for.
So the transplant has, in essence, taken and done exactly what it was intended
to do. That's right, and at least for that problem, saved their life. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I treat young children, so 5 year survival doesn't look like a lot when you're only two.
Sure,
So we really are looking for decades of survival. And the longest follow-up now, you know, is that 19 years for a cord blood, but for bone marrow transplant, it's between 30 and 40 years. But from what we can see, if you get past that initial hump, things go well. Now, in genetic diseases, it's also very variable because it depends on the disease and whether that disease causes problems just in the blood or in other parts of the body.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if the disease is treated early with a transplant and the correction is done, then the lifespan of these children can be for decades at least. And we don't really, it's hard to say normal, but
sure.
definitely extensively prolonged.
Well, that's terrific.
Yeah.
I should ask, exactly how risky is the transplantation process itself? Is the procedure itself risky, or does it come more from the aftermath?
Well, the procedure is a package deal. So the actual infusion of the cells is not risky at all.
Sure.
But there's risk involved from the chemotherapy and radiation.
Mm-hmm.
There's risk involved from a complication that can come from the cells called graft versus host disease when the new cells attack the person who received them.
Mm-hmm. When that match is not adequate.
It's not even totally related to the match. I mean,
really?
You can have somebody with a perfect match still get bad graft versus host disease, even from their own brother or sister.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But the more mismatching there is, the higher the chance you'll have that complication.
Mm-hmm.
But not everybody has it. But when it comes in its severe form, it can be life-threatening.
Sure.
So overall, if you're 1 year old, the risk is about 5% mortality. If you're a 50-year-old, the risk is about a 25% mortality. And a lot of that relates to how you handle chemotherapy in your body, how beat up your body is already by the time you get to this treatment,
right.
and how aggressive the disease is that you're being treated for.
Do you often have patients who, given the risks involved, decline to go through with this?
Sometimes we do. And I guess you have to understand that patients who come to us have already self-selected. Okay,
right.
They've
right.
already decided they're interested in a transplant.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are many patients who, when they're having a conversation with their primary doctor, decide I'm not going to go forward with a transplant, and so we never really have contact with them. But the vast majority who come to see us really want to have a transplant, and you know, your perspective on life changes when everything is fine and you hear a 20% mortality. That sounds horrible.
Right.
But
right.
when you have a zero chance of survival, and then this gives you even a 1% chance of survival, you would be amazed at how many people want to take that chance.
And let alone a 75 or 80%
right,
chance.
Right, exactly.
And those sound like pretty good odds
yeah,
at that point.
That's right. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, people say to me all the time, you're telling me this is rare, but I already have a rare disease. I already beat the odds. So the statistics don't mean as much to people in those situations as they do when we talk about it in the abstract.
Sure. And this is essentially, for many of these folks, a last resort.
That's
really,
right. It's almost always a last resort. This is not something you would elect to do.
This is
prophylactically.
Not first line treatment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Joanne, I know that you are very active in the policy arena, and I'd certainly like to talk about that a little bit. Where do things stand at this point? Is there enough funding and support out there for the supply to meet the demand?
No, there's definitely not enough funding.
Okay.
I mean, you know, there's not enough funding for the research side. There's not enough funding for the supply and demand of cord blood, just building the inventory side.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really two different things, and they come from two different pots of money within the government. And so I don't want to confuse them, because I think sometimes people think there's competition between building a cord blood bank, which is really a resource, versus doing research on cord blood to find out what the cells are capable of doing, or any other kind of stem cell. And they're really separate. So right now, the cord blood program, which started as a research project with funding from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, both for the R side and the transplant side, and then the initial bank, which was funded given to Dr. Pablo Rubinstein at the New York Blood Center in 1991. That funding has transferred to HRSA, which is a branch of HHS on the service side, and which also manages the National Bone Marrow Donor Program and the solid organ networks. And mm-hmm. that's really to have enough donors to supply organs and bone marrow and cord blood for transplant for patients in need. That whole program was reorganized, I guess, into something called the C.W. Bill Young Cell Transplantation Program through legislation that President Bush signed in December of 2005. And that put together both a coordinating center for adult donors of bone marrow and stem cells and cord blood donors, and then a single point of access registry that lists all the donors together, so that if a doctor goes to look for a donor for their patient, they can see all the cord blood donors that might be available, as well as all the bone marrow donors.
So there is a national registry and clearinghouse at this point.
Yes, and it must have been
a big step forward.
It's a huge step, and in all honesty, it doesn't quite have 100% participation yet, but it's getting there. And mm-hmm. the registry is also working with international registries so that they can exchange databases, so that a person, you know, in North Carolina just doesn't see the U.S. donors. They can see donors in France and Australia and Asia and wherever they need to look for their best match.
I see. But
that program is underfunded. It also has money to establish a network of cord blood banks in the public sector called the NCBI, or National Cord Blood Inventory. And there was supposed to be $84 million worth of funding. Well, there was $84 million authorized.
Right.
But, you know, authorization is one thing, and appropriation, where they actually give you the money, is another thing. And the appropriations have been much less than what the authorization had allotted for. So we're struggling with that and lobbying, hopefully, to get more money.
Well, maybe some of our resources will quit being spent in other places. And,
yeah, one helicopter could go a long way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then on the research side, of course, there's really not enough funding for any of the research, stem cell or other,
sure.
that should be going on.
Well, I want to get into the research side of things in a little while, but let's talk about the registry and inventory system a little bit. How many people are on the list at any given time, and how long does the typical patient have to wait if they match is identified?
Okay. So right now on the National Marrow Donor Program Registry, which is the main registry in the United States, there are close to 7 million adult volunteer donors that have been listed at one time or another. And these are adults who've said, you know, I'm willing to be a bone marrow donor if I match somebody. And even though that sounds like a very large number, because the types are so diverse, there's probably a 1 in 200,000 chance that, say, you and I match each other.
Wow.
Two unrelated people. And when you then...
Those are long odds.
Yeah. And then when you break down into ethnicities, it's more likely, say, for an African-American person to match another African-American. And African-Americans, Asians, and to some degree Hispanics are less well represented on that registry compared to Caucasians.
And I understand that's an ongoing issue that you're hoping to address.
We hope so. And that's one of the areas where cord blood can address that problem for two reasons. One, many people who feel kind of uneasy about donating bone marrow, which does require anesthesia and a procedure, or donating their cells, which involves a different kind of procedure, will donate their baby's cord blood because, again, there's no risk, and they're donating something that would otherwise be medical waste. So it's easier to recruit certain moms to donate cord blood, say, than to donate bone marrow. And sure. So one of the goals of the cord blood program is to increase the inventory of donors who are of non-Caucasian and ethnic minorities and racial minorities. And that's been successful to some degree. And if you look at utilization, more non-Caucasian patients get a cord blood transplant than they get a bone marrow transplant because they can't find the full match for the bone marrow transplant, but they can find the partial match for a cord blood transplant, even with the inventory we have right now. And in the U.S. right now, there's probably, no one knows the exact numbers because up to this point, there hasn't been any centralization of these activities. And there are about 16 public banks in the United States that are participating with this National Marrow Donor Program Registry. And then there's another one big bank in New York that is in negotiation but hasn't actually listed with them yet. But altogether between those banks, there are roughly 60 to 70,000 cord blood units, you know, that could be listed.
I see. Well, that sounds like a lot, but then again, on the other hand, that doesn't sound like all that much, considering the demand.
Yeah, the demand is going to be higher, and this new federal program has money, hopefully, if it's appropriated, to add another 150,000 new cord blood units into the inventory over the next 5 years.
I see, and that's going to be important as this expands more into adult use as well, right?
Yes, and especially if you think we're using 2-for-1 in adults, then we need even more because we take 2 out instead of 1 for every transplant.
Right. Now, when you do that, you talked about they can be completely different units. Is it important that, so you just have to look for one match and then is the other one sort of whatever or?
No. Now, I'm going to tell you what we do, but in all honesty, we haven't proven that what we do is the way we should do it.
Okay.
We just do what we do because it's built on what we did before.
Sure.
So we actually, when we pick 2 units, we look for 2 units that match the patient at least 4 of 6 places and match each other at least 3 of 6 places.
I see.
And then we also look at how big they are because in cord blood, the cell dose is just as important, if not more important, than the match. So you kind of get you need a computer for this, but the computer can do a search, line up all the units and rank them by how big they are or how well they match or both. And then from that, you have to really on paper look and see not only who matches the patient, but which units match each other.
I see. Well, that's fascinating. Somebody must have written you a good algorithm for that.
Yeah, we've had several.
Well, you know, in the policy arena, Joanne, if you had the proverbial magic wand and could get anything you wanted in terms of resources, what would you wave that wand and make happen?
Wow. well,
the wish list.
Yeah, I guess for our program itself or the area of cord blood banking and transplantation, one, we need money for more inventory, and we need money to open more collection sites so that more moms can donate. Mm-hmm. And that's money. You'd probably need a good $100 million to do it right, not just at Duke, but in the country.
Sure.
excuse me. For transplantation, we need more money to support the clinical trials that patients are enrolled on so that we can find out the best way to use cord blood and the best way to make it safe. And right now, all of these clinical trials support data management, but they don't really support the cost of the patient care. And that's a constant sort of questioning, and there's not consensus about how that should be handled. And there are many people who need a transplant but don't have the financial access and can't have one for that reason.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And then on the research side, there are fascinating tidbits of things going on with cord blood that show it does have cells that are not blood cells. In animal models, you can grow human pancreas, you can grow human liver, you can grow neural cells from cord blood. And I think if we look 20 years down the road, that cord blood will be a good source of cells for cell therapy.
I see.
For tissue repair and regeneration. And that having these banks of well-characterized, well-tested, safe units will be used for different applications 20 years from now than we use today.
I see. Well, that's fascinating, and we'll have to keep an eye on what goes on there.
Yeah.
But as I mentioned to you previously, you know, obviously when you use the word stem cell these days, the whole controversy about embryonic stem cells comes to mind, inevitably. As we were talking before we went on the air, just in the news today that President Bush apparently is getting ready to veto the next bill. Where does the type of work you've been discussing fall? Is it in a way a proof of principle regarding the vast promise of stem cells themselves as therapeutic agents if they can be harnessed?
Well, I personally believe stem cells have huge potential for therapeutic use. And in fact, I believe that the next big advance in medicine is going to be using cells as therapy. But I think it's going to take a long time. I think we're really so much at the we're at the fetal stage, the embryonic stage,
so to speak,
in terms of what we know. I think studying all of these cells is incredibly important. I don't believe one cell is going to solve the whole problem. I think different cells will be useful in different situations. I will say one thing about cord blood, which is that in the treatment of children with genetic diseases, and we're treating children who are born with diseases where they're missing an important enzyme, and that enzyme, say in a couple of them, supports development of heart muscle, liver, eyes, brain, cartilage, bone. And when we do a transplant in those children, we can see the cells fix problems in those organs. And we used to think it was just because they put more enzyme into those organs. But now we've learned that sometimes the cells are actually either changing into, or there were cells in the cord blood that could become a heart muscle cell, or something called an oligodendrocyte, which is a cell that makes myelin in the brain. So we know from treating these very sick children that
they're not fixing the problem, but bypassing it altogether.
Right, they're replacing damaged cells. So they because we know they have that potential, now we have to work backwards and figure out how to harness that potential, how to control it. Because you know, right now we put those cells in the blood and they go do their thing, but we're not in control of what they're doing.
Right.
We get lucky that they fix what they need to fix. But someday we will know how to harness their potential. And I think that there are many kinds of stem cells in the body that we need to be studying various types. I think embryonic cells are very important to study, but they're not even yet therapeutically useful. So I think we have to have many parallel tracks. Use adult cells because we can use them now, and study embryonic cells so we can use them later. And I'll bet you we discovered other cells in between that we don't even know are important today.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I saw a story from 2004 that showed it had been demonstrated that cord blood stem cells had been differentiated under control into heart muscle and brain cells. Were you involved with that work?
We have done work like that and reported it, but so have other investigators. There's an investigator in Germany named Peter Wernet who published a paper about 3 years ago showing in culture that they could take cord blood, and they said that cord blood contained a quote-unquote universal stem cell. And they were able to, from single cord blood units, grow neurons, grow cartilage, grow bone, grow liver cells, grow pancreas cells. There is an investigator out in Reno who has a model with fetal sheep, or what they call preimmune sheep. His name is Eshmiel Zanjani, and he can take cord blood cells, put them in the sheep fetus, and then look and see after the sheep is born what the cells did. And in that model, he can show that the cord blood cells grow human liver. They grow human pancreas and pancreatic islet cells, in addition to blood.
Sure.
So there's many people working on this.
So you could be looking at diabetes treatment as a result, things like that?
Yeah. And I think for diabetes treatment, that it may even be that that's one setting where the autologous cells can be used. And in our bank here in the Triangle, when a mom donates her baby's cord blood, but there's another family member who's a first-degree relative, so a brother, sister, or the father, who have type 1 diabetes, then we process that unit, but we don't list it on the registry. We just save it for that family because we think in 5 or 10 years there will be a treatment for those cells to treat someone in that family with diabetes.
I see. Within 5 years.
I hope. I can't promise.
No promises. Yeah. Right? No guarantees. Yeah. But that's... You know, in scientific terms, that's
not that long.
Pretty quick down the road. That's exciting. another story I read about in preparing to talk to you today was recently reported advance research at Kyoto University, where they were able to reprogram mouse skin cells back into the embryonic stem cell state. How important a step forward is that? And do you think that eventually that type of approach to the problem might work in humans, this turning back of the clock of cells?
Yeah, I think it's an extremely important approach, and I think it will be applicable to humans. And I think we'll be able to do DNA transfer or RNA transfer, depending on the disease, into a cell that's probably more restricted to where we want it to be, rather than just taking the embryonic cell, you can be everything, but you might be promiscuous and do something bad kind of approach.
Right.
So I actually think that's hugely important, and that we'll see development of that area.
So we may see therapeutic treatments in cells that have either already differentiated or are getting ready to, or are not strictly embryonic. And,
that's right.
Pluripotent?
That's right. And, you know, that could be very important, because if we can use our own cells wherever we get them from, they're safer for us.
Of course.
Than someone else's who could potentially react against us. So I think that's going to be very important.
So where do we stand in... It sounds like the overall agenda here is to understand the process of differentiation itself and our ability, as you've discussed, to exert external control and direction of it. Is that really the holy grail at this point?
Well, it's,
or one of them?
It's certainly one of them.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think we need to understand that in order to implement this therapy, implement cell therapy.
So I've been leading you to talk about everybody else's work. Well, let's hear about yours. What are your research activities in this area, Joanne?
So we have many things going on. One, we have the cord blood bank, and we're continually looking for better ways to procure, process, and use cord blood. Two, in the clinical arena, we're using cord blood to treat children with a category of diseases called leukodystrophies. And these are diseases where children can't myelinate their brain right. And they, fortunately, are very rare because they're devastating. But in treating these diseases...
When you say myelinate the brain, that's the... outer coating?
Yeah, so myelin is it's like the insulation on individual nerves. And we have, you know, millions of nerves in the brain and then nerves that come out of the spinal cord. And they all have this covering on them called myelin, which protects them. And when you can't have that covering or make that covering, the nerves get damaged and these babies die young of terrible neurologic complications.
And there are several other diseases involving that
right.
system.
So, you know, if we can tackle this in babies with these rare disorders, it will also have applications for adults with MS, which is a demyelinating disease, and Parkinson's, and maybe ALS, and several others that are more common and affect adults. But we've learned in these children that if we transplant them when they're young babies, they do very, very well, and we can prevent all the problems the disease would otherwise cause. But if we meet them when they already have damage, which is unfortunately what frequently happens because families don't know they carry these diseases, then we can stop progression of the disease, but we can't really get repair of the damage. So because of something we learned from a patient we treated where we saw cells turn from cord blood cells into this oligodendrocyte cell, which is the cell that makes myelin, we went back to the lab and we studied whether we could grow that cell in culture, and we can from cord blood. So we're planning trials now. We've tested the cell in animals and mice, and we're planning trials where we're going to take children who already have symptoms and put these cells directly into the damaged areas to see if they be able to quickly repair things if they got there sooner.
I see. And has that been working in the animal model?
In the animals it works, but we have not yet done this in people.
And is there a precedent for this kind of therapy that has been tested in animals and has proven successful in humans previously? Do you have a principle that's been proven here?
You know, I don't really think so. In all honesty, we're going backwards. So we know under certain circumstances the cells already work in humans.
Sure,
and now we're
sure.
saying, okay, they can prevent damage. Now we want them to truly repair, and we're asking that question. So there's not exactly a precedent yet.
I see. So we know it works. Now we just need to figure out why.
Right, and be
able to apply it elsewhere.
And control it.
Control it, sure.
Yeah.
Well, you are. When might those trials be getting underway?
We hope before the end of the year.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That's great. You know, anytime you're talking about human trials, of course, there's a whole bureaucracy in place. How difficult is it to get IRB approval for research projects like this in human subjects?
I think the IRBs are reasonable. And I don't think if you understand the system and know what information you need to provide to them that they're unreasonable at all.
Okay.
But you have to go way beyond IRBs. So to do this kind of trial that I'm talking about, we have to have an IND with the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that, we have to have proven that it's safe in animals, that it doesn't cause tumors or other problems.
Sure.
And that there's some idea that it might work. Because when you test things in children, you can't just do it because. You have to really have a reasonable expectation of benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And then to get the FDA to approve it, you also have to have manufacturing practices that show that you can reproduce what you do all the time and that you have an assay to say your cells are potent or that they're capable of doing what they're supposed to do when they go in the person.
Sure.
And that they're safe. So that part takes a lot of work.
So it's treated as if it were a new drug.
Right. That's right.
With that in mind, is there any kind of, you know, commercial potential to all of this down the road somewhere?
I'm sure there's huge commercial potential, but okay. I personally haven't pursued that side of it because that's
sure.
just not where I think I want to be.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And from the sound of it, it's a long way down the road, if ever. But I know that you have also been involved in your work in discovery and development of some actual pharmacologic treatments for leukemia. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, some things happen by chance or by luck. But when I was a fellow in the lab at Duke, I worked with a doctor named Michael Hirschfeld, who was working on studying lymphocyte biochemistry. And his work was based on some rare genetic disorders where lymphocytes were missing certain enzymes. And the lymphocytes died, but the rest of the person was okay. So we kind of came from the other angle and said, well, leukemia is a disease of lymphocytes, and if we had drugs that were specific enough to just kill lymphocytes and leave the rest of the person alone, that would be a very good thing.
Sure.
And Gertrude Elion, who was at Burroughs Wellcome and then Glaxo Wellcome and then died before it became GlaxoSmithKline, was a wonderful Nobel Prize-winning investigator who had really described how to use a class of drugs called nucleosides as drugs. And when I was a fellow in the lab, I was working with a T-cell leukemia model, and she brought me two vials of drugs and said, we synthesized these 20 years ago to be immune-suppressing drugs. They didn't work very well, but they might be good for leukemia. Test them in your model.
Wow.
So when I was a fellow, I tested them, and one of them turned out to be very active in a kind of leukemia called T-cell leukemia. So we all worked together kind of as a grassroots effort to bring that drug up to scale. It took 10 years because
sure.
it had to be developed. It had to be manufactured. It had to be tested. But it's now a FDA-approved drug for T-cell leukemia and a very effective drug.
Yeah, that must be very, very exciting and
it
very
is great,
rewarding to have participated in that kind of work.
Yeah, it's really fun. Yeah.
And what about the emotional? The intellectual rewards of all this are quite obvious, but what's the emotional side like for you?
The emotional side is very intense. And for me, even though over my life I've been able to see many successful treatments and see many children and adults live who otherwise would have died from their disease, what really drives me is the people I'm not able to help yet.
Mm-hmm.
And every single day I'm confronted with patients we either don't have a therapy for or who fail the therapy we're trying. So that's really what pushes me on and who I remember and who I keep working for.
I see. Well, that's wonderful. Joanne, we are just about out of time already. It's been quite a fascinating hour, and I really thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with our Radio In Vivo listening audience today. And wish you the best of luck for continued success with your very, very important work.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And we've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. And you can check out the website, radioinvivo.net, for the lineup. which is updated regularly as we book new appearances. So please join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. If you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our program. And maybe with your help, we can get a new roof on this place. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.